Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid. Right on.
That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Cutter. How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right, Earl.
You had a big weekend.
Oh, did I have a big weekend? It was really fun.
Yeah, you got to see the Lakers and the Bucks.
Lakers, Bucks. We had the holiday party here. It was insane. It was great.
Let me ask you, the Lakers and the Bucks, was that your first time at Pfizer?
No, it wasn't my first time at Pfizer. And I said the holiday party is actually the parade. Sorry about that. But yeah, it wasn't my first time at Pfizer. I went there for a concert earlier this year.
Yeah, what about the excitement from the game?
That's what I was about to say. You know, when you go to a concert, you get a whole bunch of young people kind of acting stupid to each other, but when you go to an NBA game, you get all different types of people, and the energy is just insane. So,
It's
insane energy. I went to my first Marquette basketball game ever, if you can believe
it. Against the Badgers.
A buddy of mine, Scott Klug, asked me. He's a good, really great guy. Called me up and with about 45 minutes notice and said, "Hey, I'm coming to my other guy is not going to make it. Do you want to go to the Badger Marquette game?" So I did, and wow.
The Badgers beat Marquette. Well, that's Sandy Williams. If you don't know by now, it's Monday. That means Monday's with my co-host Sandy Williams. So I mean, Marquette had just beaten Baylor.
I know, and Wisconsin beat him in overtime. Wisconsin was right there with him the whole game. But you know, the amount of energy, it was like a playoff game for in the pros. You know, the college basketball when they're all keyed up about it was absolutely jam-packed and lots of energy, and it was fun.
So where'd they play at?
Pfizer.
Oh, the Pfizer. It was sold out, too, I think.
Yeah, it was definitely sold out to the brim.
Well, so the Laker and the Buck game was a playoff atmosphere, too.
Right,
and
right.
I watched it, and man, it was a hell of a game.
You know, I have to say that having remembered the Bradley Center and Fiserv as a venue is so much better, so much more exciting, so much more intimacy. The crowd is much closer to everything's better. The sight lines are better. It's a fantastic amenity, and as much as it might have cost the public, I think it's already giving us dividends. Not only, just the venue itself. But the whole region there is different, and it is different because of Pfizer.
You know, you think back to the Bradley Center, and you and I have been around a little while, so we remember the arena.
Yeah, it was still there, Mecca, right?
Yeah, and what was the arena originally?
Yeah, the biggest Quonset hut in the world.
Well, and as I think back whenever I'm there, because I think UWM was playing games there, and Milwaukee Public Schools does a lot of their graduations there. I go in there.
Well, that's where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar played his games.
That's my point. There were 10,000 people. That's what it seated.
Yeah.
And you just think about 10,000, and it looks like just a little, you know, I mean, they're college arenas that,
To be honest with you, my recollection was that it was actually more fun to go to a game at the arena and watch the Bucks play than it was at Bradley Center.
Oh, no,
Bradley
no
Center was a big modern place, but the angles, you went much further away from the court.
Well, it was set up for hockey.
Yeah.
And they wound up putting the Bucks games in there. And there's no question it was kind of a barren kind of place. It wasn't warm.
Well, but, you know, set up for hockey. I've been now to hockey games at Fiserv Forum. It's a spectacular place to watch hockey games. So I just think the design of there was a period in the 70s and 80s where the design of new arenas was not for the sort of Boston Garden style intimacy that they reverted to, like the Kohl Center.
So,
Kohl Center is a very intimate place, even with a lot of spectators.
Well, you remember the Field House, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about a barren, cold place. The UW Field, is that still up? That building's still up?
I don't know.
Yeah, the Field House that, talking about a barn, that place was a cold, cold place. Big, huge place. You wanted just to heat that place.
Oh, they didn't really get it heated, as I recall.
it was always cold in that place. And, you know, even when I would go up there for the high school basketball tournaments, it was just always a barren kind of place. But anyway, I digress, man. I wanted to talk about, I saw a college football game on Saturday that was probably one of the best college football games I had seen in a long, long time. And that was TCU.
Mm-hmm. The Horned Frogs?
Yeah, the Horned Frogs and Kansas State. And TCU was ranked number 3 unbeaten. And Kansas State, they were playing for the Big East. I don't know what it was. Title. But it was one of the greatest college football games I ever saw. Football games, period. I was riveted to the television for all that time. I was afraid to even get up and use the bathroom. It was such an exciting, exciting game. And, you know, I mean, I'm a football guy. I love basketball. But really, man, you know, college football, the week before, I saw Michigan and Ohio State. And, you know, it was a blowout.
It's interesting. The pros had designed their game to be filled with offense, so you'd see lots of scoring. Now you look at the professional scores, and they're, you know, 10-7 and, you know, 15-6 and these odd numbers with very little offense capability, much like, you know, the Packers squeaked it out 28-19, and you watch college games. And they've really continued to innovate their offenses. They have a much wider range of offenses. They still play spread some places. The pro offenses all look kind of the same now. And, in fact, there was an article about how it is that innovation in football actually starts in high school, moves up through the pros.
In high school?
Yeah, I mean, what it is the innovation occurs at the high school and college level because they're not playing for the same kind of premium that they are in the pros, where it all gets very conservative and change comes slowly. And it's clear that college football's got much more excitement built into it right now, at least. The scores demonstrate the excitement. Some, you know, the scores, there's much more scoring.
Well, you know, you just look at it, and I'm sure they're going to be changing some rules next year when it comes to the NFL.
Well, how do they do it? They turn it into flag football?
I don't know what it is they can do now because it already favors the offenses. So I don't know what else it is they can do. Prime example is even Major League Baseball. They're taking away the shift. You ever see the shift?
Yeah.
And so I can see where the shift has made a major difference.
Well, you know, that's based on the money ball thing, all the numbers. So they know that a batter might hit the ball to right field 85% of the time, right? So they put the shortstop over there on that side, and they move the third baseman over, and they move, you know, the whole thing gets cockeyed, and the guy can't hit anymore, right?
My point is, so every time I go to, for the most part, not every time, but most times, I go see the Brewer game, I'm going, and it's 2-1, 1-0. Man, I want to see 14-11. Right? I mean, to me.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think baseball to the aficionado is a bit like soccer. It's the, you know, when you go to the game, it's all about the chess game you're watching. I can remember going to see a no-hit game that was 1-0, and it was a terribly exciting game to watch at the game. If you're listening to it on the radio, and if you're watching it on TV, maybe not at all. I think the difference is when you're at a game, all that science and tech, all that chess playing is fun and exciting to watch. When you're watching it on TV, not so much.
Hey, it's fun watching a guy hit a grand slam. It's fun watching a guy get a triple. I like the action, right?
Yeah.
I just do. And it's great that a guy can pitch a no-hitter and it's 1-0, but I'm sitting there. You know, baseball can be boring.
Yeah.
And now they're going to put the energy and excitement back in it from the standpoint that, you know, man, I don't know how many times, and those analytics, they got it right, because how many times you see the shortstop field the ball halfway in right field, the second baseman in right field, which should have been a hit, and throw the guy out from right field, right? The short right field. Well, that guy should have had a hit, you know. You think that
the guy ought to learn to hit the left field, that's all.
Well, yeah, he should learn to do that. But you got the guys, they pull people power, they want to see that. But anyway, I'm just saying those things have changed the way sports have been. And I don't know sometimes if those are good things long term. The purist, like you, when it comes to baseball, wants to see the 1-0.
Well, yeah, I'm not enough of a baseball fan. I shouldn't count and what I prefer to, or what I think about. But right. I do sort of think that the whole cerebral, the chess game aspect of sports is what's pretty cool. And that's what's going on in pro football right now, is the chess game has gotten very scientific. Number one. Number two, I do think that the art of tackling has kind of disappeared, and so that the running game has returned to football, which takes the scoring down.
So what you call the art of tackling is impacted by the fact that...
Well, I think it's concussion fear. I think that the practices have gotten much softer. They can't do tackling drills. They can't do what's so-called Oklahoma drill and practice very much. They've got to do all these things to avoid what is going to destroy football in the long run, which is the danger to for concussion, concussion injuries.
But I think the Sherman tanks that they call offensive linemen make a big difference when it comes to tackling, because you got to somehow get rid of that guy.
Yeah.
Before you can really get a chance to tackle. And those guys are absolute beasts, right? I mean, you look at the offensive linemen of yore, you know, had a big pouch and slow and...
Yeah, these guys are...
They're monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. I got a lot to talk about. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. How do you know about Sam and Dave?
Good songs last eternally. You have to understand that.
I know, but how do you...
How do I specifically know? I don't even remember. I just know the songs.
Sam and Dave, but he knew the song.
I know Sam and Dave. This song, I don't know. I've just heard it so many times. My parents have played it around me, so it's like...
Oh, your parents played Sam and Dave. Okay, and you remember. You got a great memory, man, by the way.
I mean... It's a good song. Like,
listen, it's absolutely a spectacular song.
Yeah, I still remember songs my parents played for me when I was like 8 years old in the car.
Are you sure you didn't remember the songs they played while you were in the womb? Because it appears as if, you know, that's how long ago. Even before you were in the womb. I mean, that's a long time ago. But welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Sheila Callback. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, here's a subject that is is going to be talked about for a long time, and I'm sure that, you know, the Supreme Court is, we thought that, and many thought, yes or no, positively or negatively, that once the Supreme Court took on Roe versus Wade, you could tell that this was going to be, safe to say, an activist court, right? I mean,
yeah, and the cases they've chosen to take have clearly been sort of carefully selected and selected on a basis that tees up very ideologically disputed kinds of matters.
Let me ask you before we go to this particular case. I thought the Supreme Court was supposed to be nonpartisan.
Well, it is, strictly speaking, nonpartisan. They don't run for office. They don't carry labels per se, but they're appointed by partisan people. And it's always been known that the court was at least ideologically bent, right? So that the people who are appointed to the court by the president tend to be people who are supposed to reflect, as far as the appointer is concerned, his or her ideology,
which really kind of defeats the whole idea that it's nonpartisan. In the end, they lean towards,
well, but see, judicial decisions, partisan is a maybe a misnomer, because there are different ways to look at the Constitution and its interpretation from an ideological standpoint. So there are those who are strict constructionists, right? They want to look at just the language. There are those who think that it's an evolving, that the Constitution has evolved over time, and its meaning has evolved over time based on the facts and circumstances of the world as the world has evolved. And those two principles might lead to different decisions, and that's the primary ideological split. But there clearly are other right now there's an ideological split that relates to the extent of the ability of administrative agencies in government to implement the law. And how much flexibility does an agency have to implement a law that's been enacted by Congress? And the conservatives would say no flexibility at all. If the law doesn't say it, the agency can't do it. And that's a very strict kind of a term. And we also have this concept of in election law, what's going on now with respect to reviewing gerrymandering and the case you're not right. going to talk about.
Well, you know, when you hear the conservatives saying we have a 6-3 majority, we
right. yeah.
conservatives, on the court.
Well, but under the Warren Court, we used to count the liberal majority as well, and it was viewed as a liberal court. And so, you know, I think it's always been looked at that way, but it's been a long, long time since we had a conservative majority. And so that's really how things have turned around. And the conservative majority, it's interesting, but the liberal majority tended to expand the power of the government from a government agency standpoint, and so that they broadened the administrative authority of the government to implement, for instance, the New Deal. The conservative court has been broadening the federal power to limit individual choices for things like abortion, individual choices associated with, in the name of freedom of will under the Constitution. It's a very unusual form of conservatism.
So let's get into the nuts and bolts of this particular case, because there's a couple different cases that are going to be happening right now at the United States Supreme Court. This one is called Moore versus Harper. And you want to talk about democracy. We keep talking about democracy is at stake. Democracy is at stake, and so when you hear this,
well, this case goes right to the heart of the sort of the conspiracy that's ascribed to the Trump rebellion and the effort of the Trump movement to overturn the election results by, for instance, having the state legislatures send a group of electors to the Electoral College that were representative of a different outcome than the vote that occurred in the state, you know, in Wisconsin. Biden wins the state election headcount by quite a few votes, And yet there was an effort to send in to the Electoral College the alternative slate that was appointed by...
That Ron Johnson had his fingers in.
Yes, that would have cast the votes in favor of Trump. So that would have been contrary to the public head count, and it would have simply followed the process of the legislature being able to select the electors.
So Sandy, hold the thought. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. You can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. And I'll tell you something. This is a case that is being heard by the United States Supreme Court. Oral arguments will be happening this Wednesday. And Moore versus Harper, scheduled for an oral argument on Wednesday, December 7th, the Supreme Court will decide whether to resurrect the previously dead independent state legislature theory in a way that some commentators believe may pose an existential threat to our democracy and could enable the Republican blueprint to steal the 2024 election. Proponents of ISLT, independent state legislature theory, believe that the U.S. Constitution bestows unreviewable power. Listen to this. Unreviewable power upon state legislatures to determine how congressional elections and by extension presidential elections are conducted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this case, listen to this. So by unreviewable, they mean that the state legislature could act contrary to their own
supreme
state,
power.
No, could act contrary to their own state constitution's restrictions. So they would be unbounded by a state constitution, and they could simply decide which electors to send to the Electoral College at the end of an election, even if the electors would represent an interest that was entirely contrary to the vote of the voters in that state. So it's essentially much like a parliamentary process. They would say that the elected officials in each state house are free to select the electors, who would in turn select the president. So you'd end up with something like parliament but different, in which the elected officials in each state would act like the parliament and would elect a parliamentary representative, the Electoral College, to go to the Electoral College and select the president. So in this circumstance, translated to current circumstances, if every state operated that way, 30-plus state houses are run by Republicans. The Republicans in the 2020 election lost the national election by over 10 million votes. But 30 state houses could send the Electoral College their electors selected. For instance, Wisconsin with a Republican state house could send the electors off that would vote for the Republican Trump into the Electoral College. It's the ultimate kind of implementation of the so-called non-fraudulent vote steal concept, this whole thing that Trump is running around talking about, which is essentially, he calls it the steal, the big steal, the fraud. All he's really saying is, too many people voted against me, and I have these state houses that could vote for me. And so, he tried to do it. He tried to do it in Arizona. He tried to do it in Wisconsin with an alternative Electoral College delegation. And this case would be the implementation through Supreme Court law. It would sanctify for instance, essentially that alternative elector group that was sent from the Wisconsin State House, and the Wisconsin State House decision would have primacy. It's contrary. The whole concept is so contrary, even like to the fundamental 14th Amendment with equal protection provisions that would suggest that everybody's vote across the country ought to somehow have some kind of equal weight. Maybe it would be disproportionate based on the way the Electoral College is set up, but this destroys the sanctity of the individual vote altogether in the national elections.
So, Sandy, in simplest terms, it stinks to high heaven, and yet it's made its way to the desk of the United States Supreme Court. And Republicans have sinisterly put this on the front burner. We can talk about Democrats and Republicans, but they crafted this scheme to take away the power of the average voter and rig it in their favor.
But incidentally, people like the founder of the Federalist Society, the conservative legal group that has been the sponsor of almost all of the federal court judges, the conservative federal court judges, including the Supreme Court, the founder of the Federalist Society came out and said, this would be a horrible precedent. It would destroy our democracy. This is conservatism beyond ideologically pure conservatism. This is a remarkable decision. If this is adopted, it would be way beyond Citizens United in terms of changing the way the American democracy is implemented. It would permit the 2024 election to have tens of millions of voters who vote for a majority. Let's say in 2024 the Democrats won by 15 million votes at the national level, and they'd find themselves with a Republican president.
So, Sandy, I don't have any faith that it won't be enacted. The fact of the matter is, it is being debated starting this Wednesday by a conservative-leaning court that picked it up. And so it would have never been picked up had it not been the fact that the conservatives have a 6-3 power over the Supreme Court. And so, you know, we can talk about what the Democrats do and all those things, but we know what this is. There's no way that anybody who sees this and understands it thinks that this has anything to do with fairness in this country. It could eventually, Sandy, divide the nation.
Oh, it will. It will.
Even worse than it's already divided.
It would divide the nation terribly. And it is the last manifestation, really, of the strategy adopted by the conservatives during the 1990s, who decided, one, to focus on state houses because of their understanding of the ease with which they could set rural against urban. And when they succeeded in getting rural against urban, they could succeed in getting the majority of state houses, even though the majority of total votes in that state might swing the other direction. And they also set about then using their powers to secure judicial appointments. Very conservative. Those were the two main strategies adopted. They've succeeded in both. And this decision would take, you know, all politics is local, ultimately. That whole concept, this would put it in place entirely at the federal level. It would take local state politics and put it in charge of national politics.
You know, Sandy, the fact that these people have crafted this, and I always say, we always talk about the inherent dangers from nations outside of this country. And we need to be focused, and we're spending trillions of dollars. I was just reading about the latest B-21 bomber,
yeah,
or whatever.
B-21,
it's a beautiful, beautiful toy. I mean,
$750 million each.
I was looking at it, and it's, I mean, it's absolutely a beautiful looking war machine. But that danger,
yeah,
is not as bad as the danger from what we're seeing internally in this country.
Yeah, and then, you know, the conservatives would argue that we have our military to keep us all safe, keep our democracy safe, and yet there are now in place the wheels to change our democracy from something that could call itself a democracy into something that would be much more like an autocracy. And there's a powerful movement in this country. I don't think they even recognize themselves that what they're setting in place are the wheels of autocracy, not democracy. And America as an autocracy, if you look at what it could do to the world, is a horrible prospect. And we ought to be far more worried about what America looks like within than we are about the dangers that might be without.
But Sandy, we are not, because you can even look at some of the things that are taking place, like the Democrats have made a decision that they're not going to have Iowa as the number one caucus place anymore.
Yeah.
And it's angered rural people who again say, well, the Democrats have left us out and they haven't done this and they haven't done that. And yet they turn things over to people who are setting this kind of thing in motion.
Well, I would say, I still continue, this is one of my axes to grind, I guess, that the Democrats need to tend to the rural vote. And if they did, there'd be far less of these kind of problems, because it has been the success of the Republicans in setting rural against urban that has allowed them to take over the state houses, okay? And they're taking over the state houses contrary to the interests of the rural vote. These rural people have been secured as staunch Republicans for reasons those people don't even understand, other than the fact that the Republicans have been able to fan the flames that excite the emotions of these people into buying into Republicanism. In the state of Wisconsin, we have a $6.5 billion surplus. That surplus could be expended in ways that would help the rural poor and the urban poor. We could set in place daycare. We could do a bunch of the things the feds ought to be doing. We could do it here in Wisconsin.
So,
Wisconsin used to be a model progressive jurisdiction that took care of rural and urban poor.
So let's do this. We have someone who doesn't want to use their name. Are they going? All right. Okay. And I really don't understand why people don't want to use their names, you know. But my bottom line is, Sandy, this, the impact of this, the ACLU and other entities are looking at this and saying, whoa, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And the real part of this, Sandy, is that the electorate, the American people, for the most part, aren't even aware.
Well, you know, a little part of me is hopeful that this conservative court took this case on because it represented fringe lunacy, and the Supreme Court was going to bury it by saying, you know what, we're conservative, but we're not crazy, and we're not going to go along with, and the American public ought to understand that this is fringe lunacy, and so they're going to bury it. That would be my hope. If they don't go that direction, and they go the other direction, then fringe lunacy has seized control of the American politic, including our Supreme Court.
So I've listened to some of those latest Supreme Court politicians, the last of a few who have joined with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And they're not John Roberts, who I think is a guy who certainly can show some independence at times. They're not, what am I thinking?
Scalia.
Scalia. You know, who at times would even though he was a staunch conservative, would do some things that were in the best interest of
Oh, don't sell John short.
Well,
he's pretty far out there. But John Roberts, I'll go along with you.
But my bottom line is the latter members that have joined are even more far right.
Yes.
Than the others.
Yes.
So they're the ones who have made these decisions. Amy Coney Barrett, and
Brett Kavanaugh
and
Gorsuch. I mean, apparently Gorsuch and Kavanaugh have uttered things that would suggest they might agree with this.
So this is
principle of statehouse control over electorals.
So that's my point. Why there is a fear that this could become a reality. It would not surprise me because these people are the same ones who made the decision we're going to do away with Roe versus Wade, even though they knew what the outcome.
Look, Roe versus Wade was a very troublesome decision. This decision, if it goes the wrong way, is fundamental to America. This is as fundamentally important as the Constitution itself in terms of its impact on how we would play out our national elections.
I know, but Sandy, it's on the table.
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line. They have looked at this and decided, we think this is worth
This is a bit like giving the Supreme Court the ability to have a constitutional convention on its own and to decide something very fundamental to America.
All right, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
The way that I love you.
That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And we are talking about a controversial case that is making its way to the United States Supreme Court that is going to be heard on Wednesday, December 7th.
December 7th is Pearl Harbor Day. Bad things happen on December 7th.
And it's Moore versus Harper. And you know, basically, it's in North Carolina. The specific case before the U.S. Supreme Court is about gerrymandering, the practice of redrawing congressional districts to favor one party, and arises from the North Carolina Supreme Court's decision to strike down its Republican state legislature's plans to grossly manipulate the state's congressional districts in favor of Republicans as being unconstitutional under the North Carolina state constitution. The North Carolina Supreme Court found that the Republican plan was an egregious and intentional partisan gerrymandering that would give a greater voice to Republican voters over any others. After a state court appointed a special master to design a fair map, two Republican legislators asked the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and rule that no North Carolina court can review state legislatures' decisions because the ISLT would make such a review a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
Right. So that, but they're basically saying is to the determination of voting that relates to federal elections is solely the purview of the state legislature and is not subject to constraints that might be imposed on it by the state constitution. So so what it's basically saying is when it comes to federal voting principles, including which electors get sent to the Electoral College, that would be an outcome that would be consistent with this whole line of thinking. That's solely the determination of the state legislature, and a state court exercising its state constitutional jurisdiction can't change it. And so the only overriding limitation on what they could do would have to be the federal constitution. And the federal constitution at this point yields to the states with respect to how voting is conducted in each state.
So let me hit this last paragraph. The Supreme Court of the United States' decision to accept Moore versus Harper's arguments is alarming because the ISLT interpretation of the U.S. Constitution has been repeatedly rejected by the highest court in the land dating back to 1916, with numerous decisions recognizing that state legislatures must still adhere to their own constitutions, and those state constitutions regularly create the sharing of legislative power with courts and governors' veto power, even when it comes to election laws. So this has been denied since 1916. And now all of a sudden it's a major issue.
Yeah.
And going to be heard. That's why I don't trust the Supreme Court that has brought this up, even in the face of the fact that it's been rejected since 1916. Tom from L.A., what's going on, Tom? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hey, Earl, first off, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that. Second is that, you know, Sandy has talked before about both sides being afraid of what happens with our government and what have you. And I would say that this is a total example of why it is that the American people, and I'll say the progressive left, have been alarming, or, ringing the bell and yelling and everything like that. You know, Milton Mayer said they thought they were free in his great book. And, it's very, very difficult for me to be able to find that common ground that we talk about sometimes on the show and meet them where they're at when this
is in their minds.
Go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the problems is it's much like the war college, where you have to impute to your enemy the worst thing they might do, and you end up projecting to your enemy the bad things that you're going to do if you get into the war. And I think from the right standpoint, maybe that's what's happening here. They're projecting to the left the notion that the left might be as willful as the right is planning on being, because the right obviously has had a very willful strategy to bend all of the federal laws as far as they can in the direction, in the arc of creating a government that is different, okay? Changing the actual pillars of government and changing the...
To their ideology.
Yes, to reflect their ideology. And so they're projecting to the left the concept that they want to do the same thing. I think the left's version of changing things is basically handled through laws in Congress, right?
So the way the system is set up.
Yeah, so I do believe you're right. I think the right's view is they're going to bend constitutional law as far as possible in their direction, and they're bending it, beyond recognition. Yeah,
Sandy,
with this
do
law.
You see that as a danger?
Yeah, Tom, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What I find even more scary is that these people that keep on voting against their best interests really are going to end up being the frogs that are being cooked and, the people that will be taken over by the corporations and not know it. I do want to say one other thing really quickly, just because I want to correct it from last Friday. CJ got on the phone and started talking about how we on the left, and he started talking about the money. I don't think anybody on the progressive side or at Civic Media or anything has said money in politics is good. We've all said money in politics on both sides of the aisle is horrible, and that is the major cancer in our body politics is money in politics. I don't agree with the right wing. I don't agree with the left wing in terms of money in politics. It's destroying we the people.
Hey Tom, we got to go to break. Thank you very much for the call. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Monday. That means